Well, this is why everybody sets New Year's resolutions, but then doesn't stick with them. Here's the key that I think, rather than focusing on the outcomes that you want this next year, focus on the identity that you'd like to build. So the goal is not to read 40 books this year, which might be a New Year's resolution you set. The goal is to become a reader, to develop that identity. The goal is not to run a marathon this year, which might be the New Year's resolution. The goal is to become a runner. The goal is not to lose 40 pounds. The goal is to become the type of person who doesn't miss workouts. And so the more that you organize your habits around an identity rather than an outcome, the more that you see the value in just sticking with it, even if it's a small thing.
You just heard from James Clear, the number one best-selling author of Atomic Habits. Hi there, I'm Celeste Headlee. Welcome to Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. This podcast brings you conversations with some of the most brilliant minds, and they've got invaluable advice for you and inspiration that'll help you navigate life in both your career and your home life. Today's episode is a great way to kick off 2021. He's the guru of habits. James Clear has new insights and some proven actionable tips that can help you keep those New Year's resolutions all year long. We will learn how to reframe our thought processes. So instead of forming habits as a finish line to be crossed, we'll learn how to use them as a lifestyle to be lived. Let's get started. All right, let's start with what you start with. And you say, start with yourself. That can be an unattractive proposition to someone who wants to find another reason why things are not going well, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there may be people who are trying to find some external cause of what's going wrong.
Sure.
So why do you say start with yourself?
Well, I mean, first, external stuff does influence life, right? Like misfortune, bad luck, randomness, other people. I mean, certainly there are a lot of factors that influence your situation or your outcomes or whatever. But generally speaking, you have less control over external factors and you have more control over internal ones. And so I think the only rational or logical, reasonable approach is to focus on the elements that are within your control. And so for that reason, I think usually positive behavior change starts by some level of internal responsibility or internal focus. And once you decide to take responsibility for that, you have a chance to become more self-aware or to take control of those elements that are under your influence rather than pointing fingers or blaming at the external stuff. And while that stuff still matters, it's just less under your influence.
So with habits, can you break a bad habit by developing a good one?
Yeah, good question. Okay, so there's three ways to break a bad habit. So first option is elimination. So you like go cold turkey, right. Cut it out entirely. Second option is reduction. So you reduce the habit to like the desired level. Yeah, for example, using my phone. A lot of people feel like they're in the habit of checking their phone too much. So for me, I leave my phone in another room until lunch each day. And so that gives me like a 4-hour block where I just kind of reduce the behavior. I don't get rid of my phone entirely, but it reduces it to a level that feels more productive to me. So you got elimination, you have reduction, and then the third option is what you just mentioned, which is substitution. And substitution is often the most effective route to take. It's not the only one. Sometimes other ones work better. But the reason is it's kind of similar to a plant. You know, if one plant can crowd out another, and a good habit can often crowd out a bad one automatically. So for example, a lot of people feel like they're in the habit of watching too much television, or they get home from work and they feel exhausted. And so they look for some way to decompress. So maybe that's playing video games, or maybe it's watching TV for an hour, or maybe it's just chilling on the couch, whatever. But they might also feel like, oh, I want to build a good habit of, say, going to the gym or journaling for an hour or something like that. And my argument for the substitution piece is you could just focus on building the good one. You could say, when I get home, I'm not going to worry about TV or all these other bad habits that I have. Instead, I'm just going to focus on changing into my workout clothes and stepping out the door. And if you focus on building that good one, by definition, when you're walking around the block or at the gym for 40 minutes or whatever, you're not watching TV. It's like a plant crowding out another. The good habit is crowding out the space for the bad one. So substitution can definitely be an effective way to change a habit.
At what point can a good habit become a bad habit? Like, can you go too far, right?
Yeah, you can get addicted to exercise, right?
Yeah. Like it's,
so I think the way that I think about this is that there are certain behaviors in life that the default tends toward the more negative side. And there are other behaviors in life that the default tends toward the more positive side. any behavior, if done in too much of an extreme, can be a bad habit. It can be an addiction, or it can be unproductive, or it can negatively influence your life. And that's one of the definitions of a bad habit or an addiction, which is that a behavior that is repeated despite knowing that it has negative consequences. You know that it hurts you, but you still can't stop yourself from doing it. And that's when it like crosses that line into addictive behavior. But to take it back to my default positive versus negative, yes, exercise could become an addiction, but it's generally defaults more towards a positive outcome, whereas, say, smoking defaults more towards a negative outcome. And so really what you're looking for in life is not to eliminate your problems. Everybody has problems. What you're hoping to do is to upgrade your problems, right? If your problem is you work out a little too much, that's probably a much better problem to be dealing with than you smoke too much.
So what's different about New Year's, right? Like, why do New Year's resolutions fail almost all the time? What makes those different?
Well, first, I think part of it is that motivation and excitement and expectation tends to ramp up when you're at the start of a new season. So that could be Mondays, the start of a new week. It could be July 1st, the start of a new month. It could be January 1st, the start of a new year, which in many cases is also the start of a new month and a new week and so on. So there's there's something motivating about a fresh start. And so I think people
get wrapped up, right?
Well, this is why everybody sets New Year's resolutions, but then doesn't stick with them. Here's the key that I think, rather than focusing on the outcomes that you want this next year, focus on the identity that you'd like to build. So the goal is not to read 40 books this year, which might be a New Year's resolution you set. The goal is to become a reader, to develop that identity. The goal is not to run a marathon this year, which might be the New Year's resolution. The goal is to become a runner. The goal is not to lose 40 pounds. The goal is to become the type of person who doesn't miss workouts. And so the more that you organize your habits around an identity rather than an outcome, the more that you see the value in just sticking with it, even if it's a small thing, right? Like reading one page does not make you a genius, but it does reinforce the identity of I'm a reader. Or doing one push-up does not transform your body, but it does reinforce the identity of I'm the type of person who doesn't miss workouts. And eventually, if you cast enough votes for being that kind of person, you start to believe it. And that's why I have that phrase where I say every action you take is like a vote for the type of person you want to become. Because ultimately what you're looking to do is build habits that cast votes for your desired identity.
So people get into trouble when they start trying to tell other people what habits they should have or making assumptions based on their appearance or whatever, that their habits are bad.
Yeah.
I mean, is it a good rule to not give people advice on that?
Yeah. This is one of the things that I thought about carefully when I was writing the book, because I didn't want to write a book where I felt like I was telling people what they should build. I don't know. Nobody wants to be told that. It's not really my job. I don't want to be that person anyway. So instead, I tried to unpack what a habit is and kind of how it works. And then however you choose to implement it, feel free to do that. But you're right. We all run into these kind of sticky situations, especially in our families, you know, like parents who really care about their kids and want them to change their habits, or brothers and sisters, or people you work with, or whoever it is, your neighbor. And changing your own behavior is hard enough. Trying to change somebody else's is really challenging. If you feel like you're in a situation where you just feel compelled to say something and like, I feel like I honestly believe this person's life would be a little better if they were able to build this habit, then the strategy that I recommend is praise the good, ignore the bad. And it's easy to say, it's much harder to practice in real life, because when you see somebody doing the thing you don't want them to do, our default is to criticize or to point fingers or to scold.
And we notice
explain.
It faster anyway.
Yes, yeah. But the benefit of praising the good and ignoring the bad is that the human brain is wired to seek satisfaction, pleasure, enjoyment, praise, rewards. Most of the things that we repeat them because at some level, it is rewarding to us. And so if you start to learn, like for example, if you want to motivate your spouse to come with you to work out, and each time you do it, it doesn't have to be over the top, but you say like, hey, I'm really glad you joined me today. This is my favorite part of the day. I'm glad we could do this together. Or I'm really proud of you. Like you didn't feel like getting in here today, but that was great. Something small that is positive. What ends up happening is no single instance does anything, but over the span of a year or two or five, their brain starts to learn. And each time I do this, I get praised. Each time I do this, I feel good. Each time I do this, it's satisfying. Each time I do this, the person I love is happy. And even if they would never say it in that explicit way, it starts to reinforce it.
And they may not even realize that that's what's happening in
their
brain.
Yeah. And that's for that reason. I think it's effective, but it's a very long-term strategy. Like literally, you just need to, as the other person, you need to say, this is how I plan to live my life, is to praise this person for doing these good things. There was actually a funny story in the New York Times of a woman who wrote this op-ed about how she was really annoyed that her husband always left his dirty laundry hanging around the house. And so she used to complain and nag him for it and so on, and he would just get mad. And so instead, she's like, all right, I'm not going to say anything when he leaves it out. But when on the occasions that he puts it in the laundry hamper, I'll like run over to him, give him a kiss, like be like, oh, thank you so much for putting it away, whatever. And over the course of the year, he learned to put it in the hamper because every time he did it, something positive happened.
Yeah, we hate to think we can be trained like laboratory rats.
Basically, but we're kind of like our dogs. We're kind of like our pets. Can. But the point here is not to treat the people in your life like a pet or like a lab rat. It's to praise and reinforce the behaviors that you really enjoy and feel like are worth rewarding.
So you're talking about long-term, which has to bring us to, I assume, is the most common question you get, which was, I thought it only takes 21 days to form a habit.
Yeah.
So let's just debunk that immediately, right?
Yeah. So certainly you see things like takes 21 days or 30 days, and those are all myths. The real answer, of course, is it depends. It depends on the habit. There was one study that showed that on average, it took about 66 days to build a habit. But even in that study, the range was quite wide. Something simple, like drinking a glass of water at lunch each day, would be a few weeks. And something more complicated, like going for a run after work every evening, would take 7 or 8 months or something. But I don't think 66 really tells you anything. The honest answer to how long does it take to build a habit is forever. Because if you stop doing it, it's no longer a habit, right? Like what you're really looking to do is to build a new normal, a new lifestyle, a sustainable, non-threatening change. You're looking to integrate this into your daily routine. And so I think that question is a little bit misguided in the sense that habits are not a finish line to be crossed. They're a lifestyle to be lived. There's something to stick to day in and day out.
It's kind of this problem we have with diets, right? And you shouldn't use the word diet. It's just change the way you eat.
Yeah, well, for whatever reason, we're like this with a lot of habits, but for whatever reason, diets in particular, very all or nothing. It's like you do a new diet and you stick to it for 7 or 8 or 9 days. And then on the 10th day, your friends want to go to happy hour or you binge eat a pizza or something. And then you're like, why bother? Like, I knew I wasn't going to be able to stick with this. I'll just go back to the old way of eating. But I think the more sustainable way to approach that is to employ this philosophy I call never miss twice. So it basically says, look, I wish I hadn't binge ate the pizza, but never miss twice. So let me make sure the next meal is a healthy one. So you pour all of your energy into getting back on track quickly. I think implicitly, we all sort of know this, which is that it's never the first mistake that ruins you. It's like the spiral of repeated mistakes that follows. It's letting a mistake become a new habit. That's the real problem. And so if you can kind of cut that off at the source and pour your energy into getting back on track quickly, well, then at the end of the year, it's just kind of a blip on the radar. And I think philosophies like that, like never miss twice and focusing on building the identity that you want to have, they help you maintain some of that consistency in the long run. And that's really the most important thing.
Is there any gender difference between the way men and women either form habits or break them?
Well, there's certainly individual differences. There are huge differences in like how your personality might influence your habits.
Or environment.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I talk about this a lot in the book. You have environmental differences. So first we have like physical environment, the things that are on your desk at home or your kitchen counter or your desk at work. They all shape the habits and choices that you might make. Whatever option is the path of least resistance or the most obvious path, the thing that's most likely to get your attention, is more likely to be acted upon. So designing a physical environment that serves your habits rather than hinders them, that makes a big impact. Then outside of the physical environment, you have the social environment. So you've got the people that you hang around. And I think the punchline here is you want to join a group, join a tribe where your desired behavior is the normal behavior. Because if it's normal in that group, then sticking to the habit is going to help you belong. And that's really the key thing is like, we stick to the habits that help us belong to the groups we want to be part of.
This was the really interesting part of your book, and that's selfishly because it aligns with what I talk about. The sense that I get from your research is that it is much easier to break or build habits in a group than it is individually.
So I have a chapter in the book, I think it's chapter 9 or 10, that's like the influence of friends and family on your habits.
Yeah.
So I knew social environment was important. I wrote a whole chapter on it. But this is one of the topics that since the book has come out, I think is even more important than I realized. When habits stick for the long run, it's often because people are part of a community where that habit is the norm. So for example, you move into a new neighborhood and you walk outside on Tuesday night and you see your neighbors have their recycling bins out and you're like, oh, we need to sign up for recycling. That's what people like us do here. Or you mow your lawn and trim your hedges every weekend. Why do we do that? Well, partially we do it because it feels nice to have a clean yard, but for the most part, it feels nice to have a clean yard because you don't want to be the neighbor who's judged by everybody else in the neighborhood. And people will stick to those habits for decades, right, as long as they live there. And it's mostly because it's socially reinforced. It's almost like the social environment, the expectations of the tribes that we are in are so strong that it's like a fish in water. It's like, what is water? You don't even realize exactly. It's surrounding you all the time. But it's true for big tribes. So we're all part of multiple tribes. Some of them are like big, like what it means to be American or what it means to be French. Some of them are small, like what it means to be a neighbor on your street or a member of your local CrossFit gym or a volunteer at the local elementary school. And all of those tribes have a set of shared habits that are normal in that group. And so the key is to, again, find a group where the desired behavior is the normal behavior. If you hang out with a bunch of jazz musicians, practicing an instrument four nights a week seems very normal because that's what everybody else is doing. So you're trying to look for those areas of overlap where you're surrounded by people who have the habits that you want to have so you can rise together.
This can work to your disfavor also, though. And we've seen that especially in the Me Too movement era,
yeah,
where men who've seen abuse and harassment happened have been like, oh, I saw that happen and I didn't even think to speak up, right? Like this can absolutely be a negative.
This is one of the challenges of habits, which is that they're a double-edged sword. Pretty much every idea that we talk about today can either work for you or against you. So like the identity piece I mentioned earlier, really crucial thing. If you look at yourself as I'm a runner, it's easier to stick with running every day. Or if you look at yourself as I'm a meditator, it's easier to stick with meditating. But identities can also be negative. Mm-hmm. You can say, I'm the type of person that has a sweet tooth, or I'm bad at math, or I'm terrible at remembering people's names. And as soon as we assign those identities to ourselves, those behaviors become easier too. And so whether we're talking about identity or the social environment or the physical environment, all of those factors can work for you or against you.
You're listening to a conversation with entrepreneur, writer, and best-selling author, James Clear. You can celebrate Women's History Month at the virtual California Conference for Women. It's on March 4th. This first ever virtual event offers an incredible lineup of exceptional and really uplifting people. It includes Dr. Jane Goodall, Ursula Burns, Adam Grant, Glennon Doyle, and Angie Thomas, among many others. To get more information and register, visit caconferenceforwomen.org. That's caconferenceforwomen, all one word, .org. Now, let's get back to our conversation.
Let's talk about habit loops, because this is one of the ways you talk about understanding, not just understanding habits, but creating ones. So explain what a habit loop is.
So the habit loop, this terminology first started with Charles Duhigg's book, Power of Habit. He had like three stages. I've added a fourth because I think it's important for... Yeah, well, the identity piece influences all of it. So the four stages of my habit loop are cue, craving, response, and reward. Cue, craving, response, and reward. So the cue is something that gets your attention, like seeing a plate of cookies on the kitchen counter. That's a visual cue that starts the habit of eating a cookie. The craving is the prediction that you make about whether that cue is worth acting on or not. So you see the plate of cookies and then you predict, oh, that cookie will be sweet or sugary or tasty. And you can imagine being in a different state, like let's say you're stuffed because you just finished eating dinner and you just had five cookies. Well, now you walk into the kitchen, you see that plate there and you're like, I can't eat anything else. And so the prediction changes. So then you choose to not act on it. So I think that craving, that second stage is important for understanding why people act differently in different circumstances. So you've got the cue, the craving, which motivates you, and then you have the response. So actually picking the cookie up and eating it. And then finally, the fourth stage is the reward, which is the benefit of doing it. So I predict the cookie will be sweet and sugary and tasty. And it is in fact, sweet, sugary, tasty, and
enjoyable. And now I want a cookie.
Yeah, right. Here we are. Now, one thing I want to add, not every experience in life is rewarding. So that fourth stage, sometimes behaviors have consequences. Sometimes they're just neutral. But if an experience is not rewarding, it's unlikely to be a habit. It's unlikely that the loop will repeat itself because your brain learns, wow, this was kind of negative or had a consequence. There was a cost to that behavior. Why would I do that again?
And interestingly enough, you are telling people to find the reward. right? So if they're doing something, then they think to themselves, why do I keep doing this? It's terrible for me. You're saying to them, well, some part of it is rewarding.
Well, every behavior in life serves you in some way. And so this is one of the challenges with good habits and bad habits. So you can think of habits as kind of producing multiple outcomes across time. So in many cases, the immediate outcome of a bad habit is favorable. It's only the ultimate outcome that's unfavorable. So for example, the immediate outcome of smoking a cigarette might be that it calms your nerves, or you get to smoke outside with a friend and socialize, or it helps you de-stress after a long day, or it resolves your nicotine craving. The immediate outcome is actually kind of favorable. It's only the ultimate outcome of lung cancer, reduced health, or whatever that is unfavorable. With good habits, though, it's often the reverse. Like, what is the immediate outcome of going to the gym for a week? Your body hasn't really changed. The scale probably hasn't moved. If anything, maybe you're a little bit sore. Often cases for good habits, the immediate outcome is unfavorable, but the ultimate outcome, if you stick with working out for a year or two or five, is favorable. And so a lot of the challenge of building good habits and breaking bad ones is figuring out how to manage that misalignment of rewards and kind of get through, for good habits, get through that valley of death in the beginning where you're just showing up and doing the right thing, but the long-term rewards haven't accumulated yet.
So how often should we check in? And I asked this, I had a conversation with a nutritionist who said, she has to be very careful to never say bad eating is a bad habit. And she says that because very often, whatever that was, it got them possibly through a very tough time. Mm. Like maybe that's what they needed to survive that time. They were in emergency mode.
It was their coping strategy.
Exactly. Yeah. And to a certain extent, oftentimes it's successful. Mm-hmm. They got through it. So how often do we have to reevaluate habits to make sure they're still serving us?
That's a great question. So a lot of the ideas that I cover early in the book are about how to get a habit started,
right,
and then about how to stick with it. But then the next question after you kind of get through those two hurdles is, should I stick with it? Is this habit still serving me? And this is one of the real challenges with the identity aspect that we talked about earlier, which is early on, you don't have the identity of the habit you're trying to build. I'm a runner, I'm a meditator, whatever. Then you employ the habit for a while and stick with it, and you keep casting votes for being this new kind of person. And at some point, you start to believe it about yourself. But the challenge of growth is that it's not a line, it's a circle. And so we come back around to where we were originally. And now suddenly you have to ask yourself, okay, now I have this new identity. Is this identity still serving me? Maybe not. Maybe I need to upgrade and expand my identity. And so sometimes I like to refer to this as like, sort of like retouching a painting. You're kind of constantly undergoing revisions of the self. And that doesn't mean you have to abandon everything that you were in the past. Like you don't need to take your current identity and rip it apart and not use any of it. But maybe there are portions of it that used to serve you in a different season that don't serve you anymore. And so I like to do this kind of reflection review at a couple different levels. It sort of depends on the habit. So on Fridays, I do a weekly review for my business. So for that collection of habits, a week is like a decent frequency. I don't actually do that much reviewing on a monthly basis. So that's kind of a dead space for me. But then annually, I do at the end of each year, I do an annual review at the end of December. And that's where I write down a bunch of just kind of how did I show up this year? So like how many workouts did I do? How many new places did I travel to? How many articles did I write? And kind of like track my habits, just give myself a baseline. Did I show up this year or not? And then in July, so 6 months later, I do what I call my annual integrity report. And so that report has three questions. The first question is, what are my values? What are my principles? So what am I trying to live by? The second question is the feel-good question, like how did I live up to those this year? So where was I living in alignment with that? And then the third question is the most important one, which is where did I fail to live up to those? And that annual review and the integrity report, they give me two touch points each year to kind of check in and make sure that my habits are still aligning with my identity or my principles or my values, things that I say are important to me. Because what I feel like, if you ask anybody, do you have integrity? Pretty much everyone is going to say yes, right? Like nobody really feels
Bernie
they don't.
Bernie Madoff would say yes.
Right. Yeah. And so what happens there, because people, you know, everybody makes mistakes. People act without integrity sometimes. You know, I've slipped up. So like what happens in those cases? If you think you have it, but then you don't act that way, why? And I think the answer is that it's a lot of just this once exceptions. It's like, oh, well, it was different in this case. It made sense here. And so having those check-ins twice a year for me helps pull me back to center and make sure I don't get too far off course, that my habits are kind of backing up what I say is important.
So how do we make sure we're not worrying about this too much? One of the other things you talk about is worry. And we do have a habit of overanalyzing everything, of stacking up too many things for us to worry about just trying to amp up and hack everything we do. How do we keep from having this get in the way of living our lives?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. I've been thinking more about qualities like this recently. And the answer that I've come to is that I think it's about self-awareness. And what I mean is that people like to act like there is one right way to do things. Mm-hmm. It's advice lands in a stronger way when you take a really strong stance on stuff like that. But I think the truth is, some people need to worry more. Maybe they're too lazy. Maybe they don't have enough urgency in their life. Maybe they're not focused. And then other people need to worry much less. They worry all the time. They're like walking around like prey animals. They're just, yeah, frantic, right? And the key is to know which one you are in the moment, right? Because all of us can be that person in different circumstances. And so if you imagine it like a spectrum, too much worry on one side, too little worry, too little urgency, too little stress or focus on the other side, where are you at right now on that spectrum? And that's what I mean by self-awareness, is that it's not saying worry or stress are never useful. They might be useful in some cases, but they also are very unuseful and don't serve us in others. And so figuring out where you are in that spectrum right now, I think is probably the more useful thing. And that requires a lot of self-awareness.
So last question for you, what question do you have? If you had a research team at your disposal and you were able to put forth a study to answer a question, what would it be?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, so I'll stick with the domain of habits since that's what we've been talking about, but there's, I'm sure, much more important questions for a research team to tackle. The one that I'm really interested in right now is how your personality shapes your habits. And so I feel like we're on the cusp right now of research kind of breaking through and understanding the genetic underpinnings of personality more. And there is some evidence of this already. So there's the most robust measure of personality is the Big Five. So it maps personality into five spectrums. And the one that most people are familiar with is introversion on one side, extroversion on the other. But there are other spectrums like agreeableness and conscientiousness and so on. And for each of those five, they have found that there is some genetic link to where you fall on that spectrum. And that makes sense because your personality is what you carry around from room to room and you carry your genes with you everywhere. So what I would love to see is to get a deeper understanding of the genetic interactions with the habits that you build. So for example, if someone's high on the agreeableness spectrum, they tend to be warm and kind and considerate. And those people, they also have higher natural levels of oxytocin, which is kind of interesting.
Mommy's hug hormone.
Yeah. Which you could imagine that someone who is high in agreeableness, it might be easier for them to build the habit of writing thank you notes, for example. Or if they're high in agreeableness and extroversion, maybe it's easier for them to build the habit of getting people together for social occasions or hosting parties or whatever. And I don't know what that is. I'd love to see like a very long list of habits. And then like if there's any connection between where people fall in those spectrums. Because I think what would be interesting is that, and this is my ultimate punchline about genes and habits, which is that a lot of the time people don't like talking about genetics or don't like talking about the biological underpinnings of behavior. Because they think it feels like, oh, it's fixed. And if it's fixed, then like it's destiny. And why would I even bother?
And yet we totally accept that dogs have biology influences a dog's behavior or an elephant's behavior. We accept it for every animal except ourselves.
Yeah, right. We feel like it reduces our free will or something. Yeah. But I think that that's the wrong lesson to take from behavioral genetics or from those studies. I think the real lesson to take away is that understanding your genetic underpinnings or your inclinations does not tell you to not work hard. Instead, it tells you where to work hard. It tells you how to design your strategy to magnify your strengths and maybe bolster your weaknesses. And so really what it does is it just increases self-awareness. It gives you a better idea of what you're naturally inclined to do. And maybe that will give you a better idea of what areas you should pursue for your career or what habits you could build easier or which habits you need a little bit extra help with. And all that does is just like helps you act more efficiently. Anyway, that's a long-winded answer, but I'd be interested in diving into that more.
James Clear, I'm letting you get away without a single habit pun, just so you know.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's James Clear, the author of Atomic Habits. It sold over 2 million copies worldwide and enjoyed 12 straight months on the New York Times bestseller list. Also spent 33 weeks on the Wall Street Journal bestselling list and topped Amazon's most sold list for 31 weeks. You can learn more about James Clear and his work at jamesclear.com. Now, if you enjoy this podcast, share it with other people. We could all benefit from a little advice and inspiration, especially right now. The Conferences for Women is the largest network of women's conferences in the nation. They draw more than 45,000 women and men to annual events in Boston, Philadelphia, Austin, and Silicon Valley. You can learn more at conferencesforwomen.org. I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. Thank you so much for listening. Be kind and be well.